everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail. This is the podcast where you control the conversation right here at the critically acclaimed network. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a film critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs. Who are you?
Oh gosh, I don't like being put on the spot. My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a film critic. I'm not prestidigitating the same way William was during his introduction. But I, too, am a film critic, and I'm here to answer your letters because this is your show.
That's right. Over here at We've Got Mail, we ask you to write into us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. You can write in with questions, critiques, your top 10 lists. You want us to recommend movies to you? You want us to talk about, I don't know, delicious potato chips?
I love potato chips.
I also love potato chips, but if you want to find out more, you got to ask. And so we got that going on.
We got the giggles today.
We're doing good. We've got soap making going on in the background today.
Yeah.
Oh.
Woo.
Oh, wait a minute. Maybe it's the fumes. Maybe it's like making really us lightheaded.
It's soap. There aren't really fumes. It's just a nice smell.
No, it's
strawberry giggles, everybody.
Just you're making soap over there, and it. I mean, this is not trying to be pejorative or anything, but it looks vaguely meth lab-ish. So
well, there's an alchemy to it.
Yeah.
There's an alchemy to it. Yeah. Oh, that is, of course, M. Lopez de Silva, who's been on the show a few times. She's working hard on our new project, Salt Cat Soap, which is a new Etsy store that we have. And we sell handcrafted soaps, 99% of them by Michelle. I might have a few geeky or schmodowny designs throughout the year, but she's doing all the incredible work so far. And it's on Etsy. A lot of people have asked, so it's on Etsy. Go to Etsy, search for Salt Cat Soap, and we add new designs for Saturday of every month. So, boom, wanted to get that information out there. And I don't know if anyone asked about soaps, but if they did, Michelle is in the background, so she can chime in. But let's just get started, shall we?
All right.
Here's our first email from.
Here's a letter from Rick. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Rick.
Hey, Bibbs and Whitney. I write this having just finished part one of Lupin. My daughter and I have already wrapped Alice in Borderland and are halfway through Sweet Home. I don't know Sweet Home.
I've heard of that one. Those are all Netflix shows.
Highly recommended the latter two, and Lupin is fun enough. While I am by no means an expert, I do enjoy foreign language TV and film and have already increased my consumption prior to the pandemic thanks to their increased availability on streaming services.
Mm-hmm.
When the pandemic both increased demand for shows and restricted supply by shutting down productions, Netflix closed the gap by increasing their offerings of foreign language titles. Many of these appear to have been quite popular, which brings me to my question. What long-term impact do you see this phenomenon having on American viewing practices? Will we treat this like an outage at the grocery store sold out of Jif peanut butter so I'll make do with Skippy for a couple of weeks? Or will viewers finally find and enjoy foreign content enough to actually seek it out? On the supply side, will Netflix find that foreign content is popular and increase their mix? Will they find that it is more cost-effective to procure a higher percentage of it, knowing viewers will be content to choose from what is offered? Will Hollywood look at Netflix's success and increase their funding and importation of foreign language films rather than remaking it with an American cast? As much as I'd like to think that this pandemic could have the positive effect of permanently expanding our worldview through experiencing other cultures' art, it's far easy to envision us to going back to our old comfortable viewing habits. Still, I hope that we can emerge with an increased desire for and access to foreign language content, as well as more opportunities for diverse creators at home. I'd like to hear your thoughts on whether or not this will have any lasting effects of this current shift. Proud patron, Rick.
Rick, that's a great question. Thank you for that. To your point, I actually think this shift actually started before the pandemic, and I started noticing over the last 10 years or so that Netflix had been, without really calling a lot of attention to it, really beefing up its foreign language offerings. Now, unfortunately, their classics are still pretty crap across the board, but when it comes to modern film, I mean, they have a ton of Spanish language, Indian films.
Yeah, I was about to say Bollywood is highly represented on
their Kung Fu movie selection comes and goes, but there have been times when it's been really excellent. A lot of their international TV has been available for a while. It's not always hitting the zeitgeist the way I think it is now, because I think it's a combination. I think because the availability of international cinema and television has been increasing. I mean, and what I mean by availability is it's easy for people to get. They don't have to go out of their way to find it.
Yeah, you can get the Criterion Channel anywhere now. That's true. In the United States.
But even so, like TV, like international TV was often kind of hard to find because it was seen as competing with American TV. So why would we go out of our way to import it unless we're like Adult Swim and we're picking up anime, for example. So we're starting to see more of that, and that's really great. And I think it's starting to make people more comfortable with cinema and television from other cultures, other countries, other languages. But yeah, I think the pandemic and the fact that a lot of the movie studios and TV, you know, stations have started either ramping down production or holding off on their stuff because they only have so much of it and they want to make sure they can parcel it out, or they want to make sure once the pandemic lifts a bit and we can send people back to theaters again, we have something ready to go. And we're seeing a lot of independent movies starting to make a bigger splash because of this. And yeah, we're starting to see a lot of international content as well. And that is a good thing.
Well, we already saw a Korean film win Best Picture at the American Academy Awards.
Last year. Parasite, that was before the pandemic. And that was a good sign.
The first crack in the armor might have been the popularity of something like Pokemon, which was a Japanese import. It was dubbed for American audiences.
Yeah, but Japanese imports have been... Pokemon was next level, yeah, but they've been doing that since Voltron.
Well, I was about to say going all the way back to Gigantor in the 60s, but there's... That was like... Like you said, it was next level. Like, the popularity of Pokemon just was something that could not be ignored anywhere, so a lot of Saturday morning animated programming started importing a lot more anime for an American audience.
This? Digimon? Bring it in! Yu-Gi-Oh! You too, everybody! Yeah. I don't know what is this? Monsters in my laundry. I don't know. Take it. It's probably a hit.
Shot through the heart, and you're to blame. Yu-Gi-Oh's a card game. that's how I reminded myself. That was my mnemonic.
That's good. I'm not gonna lie.
I think the increased consumption of international content will only continue as long as all the streaming services continue to offer it. The Netflix model might not be the best to go to because they're notorious about offering their shows for only a limited amount of time. Or however popular it is, they'll just move on to the next thing really quickly.
On the other hand, if it's already been produced, like it's like a Korean drama or a Japanese drama or an anime, like if it's already been produced, they'll put it all out there because it doesn't really add anything. Yeah. They're not necessarily going to invest money in a show past a second season. Yeah,
the big problem is a lot of these streaming platforms are leaning more and more into their own original content rather than importing other content. But they might have... I said content. I'm trying not to say that.
We're trying to break ourselves of it.
But if the pandemic continues and American productions aren't able to be made and we can only get TV shows and movies from around the world, then yes.
And again, that's an interesting, because that's a reversal of the status quo for a lot of places. Yeah. There's a lot of places in the world where there isn't as much TV and movie production as there is in America. Some places there's more, but usually it's less. Often they don't have the budgets that we do. And as a result, a lot of their material is imported from America. Some of it isn't even the stuff that's popular here that gets like really popular somewhere overseas. So this is just kind of the entertainment industry kind of like evening out. Yeah. And all of a sudden, Americans are just like, we have to watch movies from other countries the way that every other country in the world has had to do this whole time. All right, sure. What you got? Oh, it's all awesome. This is great. This is so cool.
There are other countries other than the United States, Americans. I know. It blew my mind, too.
There's at least two. That's a great question. And again, I hope, because I feel like cinematic and even television, if you want to separate them, literacy is a problem. I think a lot of people get really insular, and they're only really concerned about what's conveniently available. And I do think that having all these streaming services where more diverse stuff is available and taking a chance on it doesn't require any effort. Like, I don't need to spend an additional $4 at this video store. It's just here. And all I got to do is press a button and go, interesting. Interesting. He's a sweet tooth salaryman. That's interesting. So he does business. And he also likes desserts. And there's a whole show out of that? And it's good? Well, damn, let's watch that. And it's great. I think it's Kentaro the Sweet Tooth Salaryman. That's on Netflix. That's a really fun show. So, availability helps. But we also have to keep talking about it, and we have to normalize it. I think that's a big part of it.
It's nice that a lot of audiences in the United States are finally just sort of casually absorbing international media.
Yeah. Well, that's great. That's a great email. Let's move on.
Here is a letter from Kaylin. Hello, Kaylin.
Hi, Kaylin.
So I've been thinking a lot about the misconceptions I've had about life when I was a kid. For example, and I think this is a misconception shared with Bibbs, I thought the Muppets sang Kokomo because there was a music video on one of my Winnie the Pooh tapes. I also thought that the president was the president for life, and I was highly confused that Bill Clinton just wasn't going to be president anymore. I spent at least 6 months of my life thinking that the Backstreet Boys and NSYNC were the same boy band. And I thought that movies were basically a filmed play, which made Titanic seem near impossible accomplishment.
Yeah,
they sank a real ship.
Yeah, like it was all done in real time. I used to think that too, actually, when I was little.
It was all done in real time.
I hadn't seen any behind the scenes stuff, and I was like, oh, they shoot like different angles at different times and stuff. That sounds complicated.
Wait, they don't shoot them in order? Like some directors
do. They don't shoot it all live? Some
directors do like to shoot their scenes in script order.
Yeah, but that's.
Like, I think Ron Howard likes to do it that way.
Yeah, and he can afford to.
Yeah.
Like most filmmakers just.
Like he'll leave a location and then go back to a location.
That's a logistical nightmare. Usually we have the location, we're going to
keep all the scenes that are in that location today.
Regardless of where they take place in the script, we need to do them all today, and that's one of the reasons why screen acting can be a little trickier than stage acting.
But, but the question is, what kind of things did you misunderstand as a child, Kaylin? P.S. I bought M. Lapis de Silva's new book, Hooker, and I plan on reading it sometime soon. P.P.S. I just love that Bibbs calls Michelle his wife and partner. There's something so supportive about that, and I think it's awesome.
I think too many people try to treat their partner or their spouse, if you will, in like a possessive way, and I think that's
wife, mine.
Yeah, and again, whatever you're comfortable with. I mean, it's your life, it's your partnership. You can do whatever you like. But for me, I just want to make sure that it's abundantly clear that she has. So her own thing. She is such an important part of my life that goes way beyond the simple fact that we are married. So, she's incredible. And unfortunately, she's not in the room right now. Hey, another copy of your book sold! Okay, I don't know if you heard, but there was a yay.
We heard
there was
a yay from the other room. So thank you, Kaylin, for buying Michelle's book. What did you misunderstand as a kid? Well, I guess this is... about movies or just about life in general?
We had life in general in email, anything at all that... for movies in particular, I shared the exact same thing. I assumed that every movie was filmed by just... everyone acted out the whole thing. They went to different sets and locations. And they tried to do it all at once. And I remember very distinctly... I was watching an episode of The Wonder Years, of all things. Mm. And all of a sudden I realized, wait a minute... they wrote this. This wasn't all ad lib. And they had to find the right angle. And then they shot another angle. And they probably didn't do that at the exact same time. And then they probably had a whole other day of shit. All of a sudden, it just occurred to me how complicated making a movie must be. Mm. And that was exactly the moment when I realized I had to do something with this in my life. Movies were just suddenly so mad. There's such complicated enterprises. And for years, and I was like, I don't know how old I was, 8 or 9. I just believed the magic.
Mm.
And now all of a sudden I'm like, wait a minute, that magic is work? I want to do something in that line of work. That's an amazing line of work.
I'll say this. I can't remember a time in my life when I thought like a fiction was real. I'm watching a TV show and thought that's a real person somewhere.
Okay.
But I was confused about sort of the production, especially when it came to cartoons. Because I like to draw, I like to sketch. And when you're a little kid, you just sort of draw the whole drawing.
Yeah.
And then I went to like an animation festival when I was like maybe 9 or 10. And my mind was blown when I realized, wait a minute, they don't redraw the whole character in every single frame. They only like redraw the blinking eyes or the part that's going to move. And I was like flipping through these cells and one is like just an arm or just an eye because that's the only part that's animating. That's all you need to do.
If you're saving time and money anyway, yeah.
And I thought, two things simultaneously. One, wow, what an efficient way to work. They figured it out. I wouldn't have thought of that. And then the other part of me is like, I feel so cheated that they're not drawing the whole character every time.
This
for
is
me.
What you think of me? You couldn't be bothered to draw the whole character every time?
You think I wouldn't notice? Because I didn't. That was a misconception I had about the art of animation.
It's like when you learn that Uncle Sam isn't real. I didn't want to say like any other like holiday deities in case kids are listening. But like, yeah, like, oh yeah, was that a real guy?
Unless you have an uncle named Sam.
Well, then, I suppose that would be true. I had another one I was just thinking of.
The Monkees, the Beatles, and Simon and Garfunkel are the same band. All three, like, I heard a song by any one of those, and I thought they were all the Beatles.
I thought, this is the silliest one, and I'm not going to reveal to you how old I was when I found out this wasn't true.
You were 35, weren't you?
No, not that bad, but suffice it to say, if I told you, you would all laugh. Mm. Okay. I thought that the carpool lane was supposed to be for cars with pools in them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason I believed this...
You were 35, weren't you?
Not quite.
All right.
The reason I believe this is because there was an animated kid show called Beverly Hills Teens. It was all about rich kids in Beverly Hills.
I watched that thing on the regular.
It was like counter programming the Gem and the Holograms. Like that was the market they were going for. And you can see it in the opening credits. If you ever watch the opening credits of Beverly Hills Teens, one of them has a limousine with a jacuzzi in the back.
Yeah, they are like they're that wealthy.
Yeah. So I thought, well, we live near Beverly Hills. I grew up in Southern California. The rich people have everything.
Hmm.
They probably paid off the highway so that only the rich people with their carpools should be. And I remember my dad was in the carpool lane once because like the whole family was in a car. And I was like, Dad, I don't know how we're getting away with this. And then it was not explained to me for many years. They just sort of like rolled their eyes and didn't know what the hell I was talking about. And then they just never bothered explaining it.
Yeah, I had an older sister who could teach me in such things.
Yeah,
she's 3 years older than me, and so we actually had a very serious conversation once about Beverly Hills Teens.
Really?
Because we were looking at that, and we were both looking at it. It's like that's a big car. You couldn't really fit a lot of people in a jacuzzi. And my sister pointed out to me, you know what? Every time you stop, the water would all come sloshing out. I was like, yeah, you're right. This is bullshit. Like. There's no pool in a car. And then I saw one in live action. There was a joke in the movie Brain Donors.
He gets in this gigantic
long limousine and there's like this little one-person hot tub in the back.
Forgot about that, yeah.
But
that probably helped convince me.
Well, I also noticed in that movie that it's like a bubble bath.
Yeah.
And Mel Smith is sitting in it and he's covered in foam. And I just knew right away, no, it's just foam. There's no water in there. They just filled it with foam and they had him got in and they tried to fake it.
You lied to me. Bonk.
So the idea of having a pool in your car is like, that's just absurd. I figured you out. Felt like such a cynical asshole at such an early age.
Anyway, we all believe things when we're kids, either because someone told us that, not thinking it would actually take.
Yeah.
I know a lot of parents like to play little jokes on their kids about like what, you know, like Calvin and Hobbes used to have jokes about this all the time. Like, Dad, what's wind? And Dad would say, it's trees sneezing. And Calvin would say, that's not what it is, right? And Dad's like, no, but the truth is a lot more complicated. And it just cuts to like a windy day. Trees sure are sneezing today. Like that's, had a lot of that when I was a kid. A lot of parents just telling me stuff, thinking that it was funny, and then I just learned stupid things.
I'll have you know I don't do that with my son.
Good. Because Michael Ironside told you not to.
That's true. Michael Ironside, before my son was born, we got to interview Michael Ironside. And I told him, well, I'm really nervous. I'm about to have a son. And he pulled me aside. He actually put his arm around me.
I saw this. It was a hell of a moment.
And he said, let me give you some fatherly advice. Never lie to your child. Mm-hmm. If you don't know something, just say so. And I said, you know, that's good advice, Michael Ironside.
Really good advice from Michael Ironside. And you should write a parenting book.
It's actually helped me.
Good. That's nice.
When you don't know something, just say so.
Right. Well, thank you for the fun question. I hadn't thought about some of those things in a while. What do we got next?
Let's see. Here's a letter from Jeremy. Hello, Jeremy.
Hi, Jeremy.
Hello, Messrs. Bibiani and Seibold. First off, I would like to take the time to thank you for thank your Patreon member who requested/forced you to rewatch Cats. My love for that movie is immense, despite having nothing to do with the original intentions the filmmakers have. What a movie. And I loved hearing your thoughts while suffering through it again. I had some thoughts about the plot.
Real fast, just in case anyone's not following along or maybe you're new. Recently, we had a Patreon member request that Whitney and I release a feature-length commentary track for the movie Cats that you could sync up at home if you wanted to. And we did. And it was a hell of a night. Aww. And that is still available on the feed. And if you haven't listened to it yet, that's a thing you can do.
We don't drink on the podcast. We've done it twice in the past.
Always a mistake.
And no, the second time it wasn't a mistake. It was for our Yule log commentary.
Oh, you know what? You're right. That one was kind of fun.
We just had a few sips of brandy. We didn't get like smashed drunk or anything.
I apologize. That one was fun. Yeah. Yes.
But there was a podcast we did long ago where I got smashed on mic and it was not becoming.
No, it wasn't even a good show.
No. Like you had me get drunk and review The Lorax, and it was just a really difficult thing to do.
Well, yeah,
like,
you've never been drunk before.
No, that was my first time.
You chugged it too, instead of just sipping it like a normal person.
Because I hated it. I didn't want to drink. Anyway, I had some thoughts about the plot of Cats. Changing the opening song from being sung to the audience in an auditorium to the character of Victoria seems to suggest there's some sort of Cats class system. Cats that are Jellicle and cats that are not Jellicle.
Yep.
With this unknown newcomer to their area, the bourgeois class of cats are trying to determine whether or not this new cat does belong to their class or not. That's why they have to ask Victoria if she can see in the dark or land on your feet, find your way blind when you're lost in the street, etc. My theory, however, is that Victoria is actually a plant. Sent there by Grisabella in order to manipulate the Jellicle cats to steal the Heaviside Layer nomination. It was mentioned that the reason Grisabella was ostracized was because she was caught spending time with McCavity, meaning that at some point they may have been in cahoots with each other, meaning she wanted to steal the Heaviside selection. We clearly see what McCavity was willing to do, but maybe it was actually all part of Grisabella's plan and not McCavity's. She found a regular proletariat cat, Victoria, trained her to act Jellicle, to infiltrate the high-class society, and had McCavity kidnap all the Jellicle candidates for the Heaviside Layer, then had Old Deuteronomy taken away to distract all the other Jellicles from what would have actually been going on and cause them to panic, then had McCavity return Old Deuteronomy while everyone was distracted by their attempts to have the magical Mr. Mistopheles bring back Deuteronomy, because we didn't see how Old Deuteronomy actually gets returned, manipulates the Jellicles to hear Grisabella's banger of an audition, memory, and while all the other Heaviside contenders are still stuck on the boat, and because of all of the twists and turns they were put through, only come to the conclusion that Grisabella has to be the chosen one to ascend. But I doubt that the filmmakers put that much thought into the plot, and it really is as bad as we think it is.
Headcanon is fun.
Isn't it just?
Headcanon is a delight. I have plenty of headcanons of my own. Mm. That's a little elaborate for my taste, but whatever makes the movie fun for you, knock yourself out. What I do like about that theory is that it's almost a redemption for McCavity. Is that he's actually might have been doing it for Grisabella in some way, and that maybe they're actually like cool, and maybe that's why he was like hanging on, like, Grisabella, I want to go with you, we're buds. Like
maybe every time he vanished, he was trying to say, McCavity doesn't want this, but he just turned and said, McCavity!
And then another place, doesn't want this. Oh, friend.
Grisabella was teleporting him around against his will.
Oh god. I don't like the idea of Grisabella being like evil because I feel like she has it hard enough as like the sex worker who's shamed by this high class society. But I do like the idea of her like sort of undermining their power in kind of a Robin Hood kind of way. Uh-huh. So that's kind of fun, yeah.
Anyway, I could continue to rant about Andrew Lloyd Webber's music, but I'll shorten it to this. It all sucks. On this, we agree. Except for Phantom of the Opera. I may defend that stance in a future email, but this one is long already.
Phantom of the Opera, I'm willing to go with that.
Wishing you a better 2021 going forward, your faithful Canadian listener, Jeremy.
Jeremy, thank you so much, and we hope you have a wonderful 2021 as well, and everyone listening. Mm. Cats.
Holy cats.
They're cats.
Maybe the Heaviside Layer wasn't death. Mm. But it was there a chance to evolve Pokemon style into humans.
Maybe the friends we made along the way were the Heaviside Layer.
Maybe the cats were the friends we made along the way.
No, I think like the Heaviside Layer is like, no. The friends we made along the way are the Heaviside Layer. Think about it. Imagine if Buckaroo Banzai said that and how like profound that would be.
Remember, wherever you go, there you are.
First time I heard that, it blew my goddamn mind. I'm not kidding. I was like, whoa. Yeah.
When I was...
It's like that Beatles song, without going out of my door, I can learn all things on earth. I'm like, whoa.
Here we go.
You must have a lot of books.
A friend of mine pointed out to me in junior high school that I was a big Star Trek fan at the time. I still am. But he said, you know, in Star Trek, they say set phasers on stun. It's good life philosophy, isn't it? Never set to kill, just stun.
Yeah, that's good. By the way, before we move on completely from Cats, I want to mention something I forgot to mention, I think, on the commentary track. There's something that needs to be stopped on IMDb. And that is putting quotes from movie trailers in the quotes section. Because inevitably, you end up with the blandest quotes. So I looked at, like, the quote. I was trying to find, like, a lyric. And I thought maybe it'd be easiest just to find it on IMDb quotes. Because it's a famous lyric. I want to make sure I got it right. But I looked at the IMDb quotes. And it was things like, from trailer, here we go! And I'm like, what? That's not worth writing down. That's not a memorable quote. Anyone says that in everything. That's like putting a quote from a movie, like, from the trailer, let's do this. Like, no, that's not a quote.
Let's do this is this generation's let's get out of here. There was a study at some point, and they would put this on like those film trivia slides they would play before the movie back when they did that. Now it's just a whole digital presentation. But it was, let's get out of here was the most commonly used phrase in Hollywood productions.
Interesting.
Like, wherever they are, let's get out of here. Like, we're in a bar, let's get out of here. Oh no, the sky is falling, let's get out of here. And let's get out of here, they, when it was pointed out, they stopped using it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh no, this is a cliched line of dialogue.
Yeah.
Let's do this is still a thing. It's like, they're like not moving
years,
away. Yeah.
I've lost track of how many, just every time you see that in a trailer, just be like,
okay, let's do this.
Ah, Deadpool, why? Why are you doing it? You're so above this, Deadpool.
Deadpool, like, you'd think he's like, he'd say something funnier, like, let's skin this monkey, or whatever he's got.
I was just picking a name out of a hat. I don't specifically recall if Deadpool said that, but it feels like it's that kind of vibe.
Give it something unique to the character, not just let's do this.
Yeah, I just want someone to say, like, let's giddy up, like, just something fun, you know? Mix it up a little.
Let's paint this wagon.
Yeah. Let's carve this jack-o'-lantern.
Let's stank this hooba.
Yeah. Let's gild this coffee table.
Here's a letter from Starship. Hello, Starship.
Hi, Starship. That's an awesome name.
Hello, gentlemen. I just listened to your thoughts on how movies are advertised, and I wanted to share a small anecdote of my own. I remember that when Bridge to Terabithia came out in the mid-2000s,
it was advertised
as a big fantasy movie. Having read the book in school, I remember thinking that either they have drastically changed the plot, or they're going to be some very upset children and angry parents, and sure enough, the latter happened.
Yeah.
Bridge to Terabithia is about I think they're like 11 or 12.
Kids,
boy and girl. I think, I don't remember the circuit. I think the boy moves into town, meets this girl. They become friends, and they find this island, like in a river near their home.
Yeah, it's kind of like a secret garden kind of thing.
Yeah, they're able to go there, and it's just this little like nature preserve that they declare to be their own. And because they're Narnia fans, they decide to give it a fantasy name, and it's Terabithia. But they have to swing on a rope to get there, and that's a big plot point. And I'm not going to tell you what it is, but it'll make you cry. And because that is a fucking tragic book, and you shouldn't give it to children because it breaks your heart.
So basically, this is like advertising. Yeah. I don't know if they still teach this in schools, but this would be like advertising a separate piece as like a fun frolic through the trees, and you're like, no. People are going to be mad. Yeah, they advertise the Bridge to Terabithia like some kind of one wonderful.
Funderful is fine.
I was going to say fun and wonderful. Instead, I said one and funderful.
And when they go there, it's like that's their fantasy world. And in the movie, they added in their imagination, monsters and things. And that's the only part they focused on in the advertising.
Yeah, and it turns out that is not the tone at all of what you're going to get. And you're going to be pissed. People were pissed. I remember. Very clear. Yeah.
Oh, there's giants in this thing. No.
No, mostly giant depression.
continuing with Starship's letter. Since I didn't see that many 2020 releases, I can't really drop a top 10 this year. However, I did see a ton of older movies last year, so I thought I would share my top 10 discoveries of last
year.
Yay!
That's awesome. We'd love to hear those. Really fun.
Number 10, Onibaba. I love the way this film looks. Every frame is beautiful. I love Onibaba.
I don't sure if I've seen that one.
I haven't.
It might be confusing with something else similar.
1966, I think it came out. It's by Kaneto Shindo, who also did Kuroneko and a few other
I've seen Kaneto Shindo films. I think I'm just confusing it with like another. So what's the other one that we did? We did a podcast on a supernatural samurai film.
Oh, we did Ugetsu.
Ugetsu, that's
which is a Mizoguchi film.
That I was thinking of Ugetsu, you're right. Okay. I haven't seen Onibaba.
Yeah, Onibaba takes place in a field of grass, and it's constantly waving and making noise. It's just above your head. And rogue samurai, after a failed war, are wandering through this field where the main characters, mother and her daughter, lay in wait in a little hut. They lure samurai into a pit where they fall to their deaths. They climb down there, strip the corpses, and sell the armor, and that's how they make their money.
Right.
And then, and they're just horrible people. They're just murderers.
Yeah.
And then two things happen. A young man comes through, and the young woman says, "Wait a minute, this guy's actually kind of like, let's pay attention to this guy. Let's not kill this guy. Kind of sexy. Let's have some sexy times." And the mom's getting really jealous of their relationship.
Yeah.
And then another samurai comes through, and he's wearing an oni mask, like a Japanese demon mask. We can't see his face. Mm. He says, "Well, I wear this mask because I'm too beautiful." And so they try to lure that guy in. There's something weird happens with the mask.
I imagine there are twists and turns.
There's twists and turns. I don't want to give it away. But see Onibaba. It's really, really terrifying.
Awesome. Well, I guess I'm going to make sure I do.
Number 9, A Night to Remember. I put off this film for a long time because I didn't think a film made in the 1950s could put off showing the sinking of the Titanic. I was wrong.
Mm-hmm. I'm also a big fan of, because there were two Titanic movies come out around the same time, A Night to Remember, which is excellent.
Mm.
And also Titanic. They just had another one called Titanic. Mm. And there is one bit of melodrama in the one called Titanic from the 1950s that is so much more effective than any of the melodrama in James Cameron's one, that it's one of the reasons why it took me a while to, like, get on board with James Cameron's, because I'm like, where's the bit with the dad and the son?
Aw.
Like, it's so goddamn sad.
Yeah, I actually haven't seen that Titanic, and it's been a long time since I've seen A Night to Remember. I remember they used the F word in it, though.
Really?
Yeah, in A Night to Remember.
I don't remember that at all.
Talk about somebody being fucking rich, I think.
I don't remember that at all. Okay.
I'll have to rewatch it.
Maybe it's been a long time. Yeah. Okay, crazy.
Number 8, When Marnie Was There.
Yay!
A Studio Ghibli film that made me cry my eyes out. The way the movie deals with grief and dealings with abandonment hit me right where I live.
I love that movie. It is such an underappreciated Studio Ghibli film. Mm-hmm. A lot of people kind of wrote that one off. That movie is absolutely stunning, and I love that it's about introversion, which very few movies really tackle, especially not like fantasy films for kids. It's so good.
Yeah. Number 7, Airport 77. This was just fun.
That's I've actually never seen any of the airport movies.
Oh yeah,
there's a people.
They're terrible.
Well, the first one got nominated for a bunch of Oscars, didn't it?
I mean, they're a blast to watch, but they're just these big, dumb, clunky Hollywood entertainment.
For people who don't know what we're talking about, in the 1970s, a lot of people know that in the 1970s, the big, at least until Star Wars came around, like the big blockbuster trend was disaster movies, like the Poseidon Adventure, the Towering Inferno. And one of the first films in that wave was a film called Airport, which is about the disaster at an airport.
What? I think it was 75 Airport? Let me look up the date.
I think it was a little earlier than that. I feel like the first one was like
Airport
71.
77 was the sequel. One
because
of the
there's
sequels.
Like four of those things. And that's the thing. It's spawned like this big franchise that didn't end until I think Airport the Concorde, which was like really? I think 81 or something. Like, or 79, like right around there.
The first one, Airport.
Yeah.
Came out. There was a novel in 1968.
Yeah. And it was and the person who wrote it was the person who also wrote the movie that. Wrote Zero Hour, which is the movie that Airplane is
is
a spoof of.
Arthur Haley is.
So he's like responsible for like all of the airport disaster. Yeah,
the first
fiction.
Airport was 1970.
Yeah, right at the end of there.
Airport 1975, Airport 77, The Concorde, Ellipsis, Airport 79.
Okay.
And that's where it ended. It's just
so
the
there
four.
Were four big giant movies, and The Concorde was a massive failure. But like there was this big franchise, and I love when people talk about like all their franchise movies as just like, the Fast and the Furious, these movies will be popular forever. And I'm like, give it a couple generations.
Yeah.
Everything dies. Like there's a handful that haven't yet, but there will be a time, I'm sure, when James Bond dies or becomes part of the past or just not interesting anymore. And just and becomes like something like, you know, Dracula, which is part of the firmament, but isn't like its own thing anymore. Like it's everyone can do it. Like,
I'm willing to bet
franchises die is my point. They dissipate.
Yeah, I'm willing to bet. I'll put money on it that James Bond will vanish from the popular consciousness.
I mean, not right away, but not
no, like it's gonna. It's. I feel like it's already like kind of dwindling a little. Like people are looking forward to the next one.
Sure,
but and there's all the speculation who's gonna play Bond next.
Mm. Whatever. Someone, I don't know, someone British probably.
Daniel Day Kim, get him. He'd
okay.
be good.
Well, okay. be cool, yeah. But regardless, you're right. And I think one thing I've noticed that's kind of interesting is I've seen a lot of like, and we'll get back to the letter obviously in a second, but like a lot of like younger people, like millennials, who like suddenly like I saw this article like when they released like all the Bond films on Netflix for the first time in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, there's a lot of young people who were kind of experiencing Bond for the, maybe they'd seen the recent ones, but I'd never seen the history of it. And a lot of people looking at him like, he's a monster.
Yep.
He's a tool for the really conservative government, does a lot of really terrible things. He's an unapologetic murderer, commits sexual assault on more than one occasion in these things, and is never taken to task for that.
Huh?
Do we need this? And the the answer to that question is maybe not. At least not unless he evolves dramatically. So yeah, it could go the way of the dodo, and maybe he should.
The last James Bond film should have been GoldenEye.
You think the very last
James last Bond film. One, because James Bond is a Cold War figure. He's a Cold War character, and GoldenEye was the first one made after the Cold War.
Yeah.
And in it, they just said, well, you know what, James Bond still needs to clean up a little bit after the Cold War, because that is about sort of things last that were held over from the Cold War, about all this like old Soviet stuff that we still needed to deal with. But yeah, it kind of just sort of put James Bond in a light, saying, we don't need you anymore. You're a dinosaur. Here's your one last hurrah where you get to sort of clean up after the Cold War, and then we're done. We don't need this MI6 crap.
Again, if we were focused on Bond as a narrative instead of like an ongoing franchise, that makes perfect sense.
Well, just as a reflection of the political time.
What I would like to see happen with the James Bond franchise, if they absolutely must continue it in some way, we're done with theaters.
Hmm.
We are going to do James Bond as a period piece.
Oh, there you go.
Set in the 50s, 40s, whatever the book is, following closely the original novels.
Mm.
And we'll do it like they did the Sherlock series, which is like we'll do like 3 2-hour episodes a year.
Okay.
And we'll do Dr. No, and then we'll go right to From Russia with Love, whatever the next one was.
Mm.
And I think keep Bond in that era where he makes sense. And then, yeah, please add additional commentary. We're wiser now as a people. We don't need to just linger on everything. Anyway, we got way off the beaten track. Let's keep going.
Number 6, One Cut of the Dead. Another one I put off. I am so sick of zombie movies that I avoided this one. However, it turned out to be one of the most feel-good movies I've ever seen.
Damn.
Still not in my experience.
I haven't seen that one either. I really got it.
Number 5, The Straight Story. I love David Lynch for all his weirdness, but it was nice to see him make such a lovely movie that felt distinctively him.
Yeah. It's not David Lynch, and yet it's totally David Lynch in every single way. Yeah. It's one of the most interesting films he ever made.
Number 4, Orpheus, the Cocteau one.
Yay!
I was actually unfamiliar with the myth until I saw this movie. Gorgeous. Oh, yeah. There's a lot of Orpheus movies that are just influenced by that story, by the myth. So whether or not you've, like, studied up on the myth, you know it just through popular entertainment.
Yeah.
Number 3, Same Time Next Year, the movie that made me cheer for the two adulterers. Number 2, Freebie and the Bean.
I've actually never seen Freebie and the Bean.
I hate myself for enjoying this as much as I did because it's full of bigotry. But I'm a sucker for a buddy cop movie, and James Caan and Alan Arkin had a surprisingly great chemistry.
It's been argued that that's the first proper buddy cop film.
And
I can't really dispute. I mean, buddy cop, I guess sitcoms like Car 54, Where Are You? But as a buddy cop film, Freebie and the Bean is considered typically like the one that codified the genre.
Well, the two cops having very different personalities.
Mm.
Car 54, Where Are You? Was
just two wacky
two
cops.
Two wacky cops. Yeah, they didn't. It's like clones of the same character.
Well, if you want to go that and you want to take it more seriously, In the Heat of the Night.
Okay, In the Heat of the Night.
Yeah. So like it had been done, but like
that's not a buddy cop comedy. But
not as a comedy, but in terms of like mismatched cop thing, like there was groundwork that had been done before.
Yeah, the modern era was definitely 48 Hours, but
I think 48 Hours wouldn't exist without Freebie and the Bean.
For sure.
So there you go.
And number 1 is The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
Yeah.
What can I say about this? It was a blast from start to finish. I fell in love with the three main characters and their journey. Thanks for another year of great shows from you two guys. It helped me through the dumpster fire that was 2020. Sincerely, Starship.
Yeah, I grew up loving Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. I think it was the first unabashedly queer film I had ever seen, and I thought it was really, really great. Recently, as I watched it and heard some other people talk about it, I've come to realize that there's at least one scene in that movie that is frustratingly has racism in it, and I don't think it ruins the entire movie, but that one bit is just sort of like, well, damn it. But can we go back to the dress made entirely out of sandals? That was cool.
Well, it deals with contemporary issues and came out at a certain time.
It's still mostly wonderful. There's a thing that Michelle and I believe, like, we don't really believe in like guilty pleasure movies, but there is such a thing as a shame watch. In which there's a movie that we like a lot of this movie, but it came out from a different time, and there are elements of it that are not good. that are in no way progressive, in many cases regressive, or there's one bit or character who's racist. And that one bit, you can't ignore that bit. You just kind of sit in it and go, well, yeah, okay, that's in there too. And if you want to enjoy the rest of it, you have to acknowledge and work through the fact that one part of it is shitty. Case in point, I know a lot of people who love Silence of the Lambs, but also have to acknowledge that it was really shitty for the trans community.
Yeah, yeah.
It was. There's a lot of great filmmaking in there, and if you still like it, okay. But I think you can't do that and ignore how shitty it was to the trans community. So for me, that's become a shame watch.
Yeah.
You know? Anyway, let's move on.
Okay. Here is a letter from... Oh, I just had it. Here's a letter from Brett. Hello, Brett.
Hi, Brett.
Good day, fellas. Over the weekend, I did a double feature of Iraq War movies set stateside, In the Valley of Elah and The Messenger.
Oh.
The Messenger is a much better film, but I also enjoyed Elah to watch Tommy Lee Jones chew the scenery. Anyway, I was curious what your overall thoughts were on how the Iraq-Afghanistan wars were portrayed in film thus far, especially how something like 9/11 had been portrayed. Similar to how no one wants to watch a COVID movie yet, with the popular exception of possible exception of Host. I think the war was a sore subject matter up until we really had some distance from the matter. Since it has been many years since America has participated in the war on terror, which films really stand out as to how they portrayed the disgruntled attitude of the time and which ones ring false? Looking forward to hearing your thoughts, Brett.
That's a good point. Yeah,
yeah, there was an attempt right away to reconcile 9/11 in film.
Yeah, I think there was an initial, like, we were pulling back on anything that evokes 9/11 without being 9/11.
Like, there were a lot of action movies, or just movies that were delayed or recut, or probably just failed because of timing.
Yeah, like, Some of All Fears featured a terrorist attack on American soil. That's a really good movie, by the way, but bad timing.
There's the movie Collateral Damage, an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie that isn't really well regarded because it deals with terrorism.
It's hardly his worst movie. It's actually not that bad, but just the timing was shit.
Yeah. And then there was a movie I'm very fond of, actually, called Big Trouble. It was a Barry Sonnenfeld comedy film with this wonderful cast. You know, it's got Zooey Deschanel and Ben Foster and Tim Allen and Rene Russo and Stanley Tucci and Patrick Warburton and Dennis Farina and a slew of really great actors. It's one of the plot points was Tom Sizemore and Johnny Knoxville have stolen a suitcase-sized nuclear bomb, and they don't really know what it is, but they know it's worth a lot of money, so they take it, and they say, okay, we're going to hold you guys hostage, and we're going to take you on a plane, and one of the jokes in the movie is, oh, haha, isn't it so funny they can just carry that thing onto a plane, and airport security sucks, and, you know...
Yeah, that's not funny right now.
It was going to be released right after somebody hijacked a plane and flew it into a building. So,
that's bad timing. We're not going to do that shit. Yeah.
But then there were a lot of filmmakers, like Paul Greengrass made United 93 shortly after 9/11.
Which is very specifically about just the events of the plane that actually, where the passengers actually took over the plane and they crashed it. Probably saving a lot of lives, but also sacrificing themselves in the process. That is one of the movies that is so unbelievably harrowing. Absolutely impeccably directed. You are there, terrifying. The last shot still haunts me to this day. I never want to see it again. I don't need to see it again. It was so intense. I respect it. I admire it. I would tell anybody that it's brilliant. And I don't need to see it again.
Yeah.
Point made. Thank you. I don't know if I could live through it like that.
Yeah. United 93 came out in 2006, the same year as Oliver Stone's World Trade Center, which I didn't see.
Yeah.
Which was about the first responders.
Was resoundingly rejected.
Yeah. Not a lot of people like that one just because they're trying to make cheap melodrama.
Yeah.
If you'll notice, after 9/11, a lot of action movies got really gritty all of a sudden. Everything was really kind of...
Everything scaled back.
Dark and down to earth. Well, we didn't have the fun big scale. Oh, look, isn't it fun that a spaceship is blowing up the White House?
Yeah, that got pulled way the hell back a little bit. We started getting more Bourne identities.
Yeah.
Because I think
a lot more Paul Greengrass, actually.
That's true, actually. And I think a lot of it was people were... when they saw violence on TV... in whether it be a movie or a TV show or whatever, there wasn't as much distance from it because so many people were in New York, new people, saw the horrors on television, that all of a sudden this isn't like, oh, what a fun suspension of disbelief, all these explosions. Like, no, it's not fun right now, and it won't be for a while. Everything got a little too real, and a lot of people were genuinely traumatized. whether they were literally New York or not. That's a traumatic event that an entire generation of people lived through. And responding to that by thinking maybe extreme violence or maybe, or even just like making enormous scale violence seem fun is in poor taste. And there's an argument to be made for that. And boom.
I feel like we were so eager to reckon with this dramatic event in popular cinema that a lot of filmmakers really didn't know how to handle it yet.
Yeah.
And even like years later, was it 2010 or 2011 when that film Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close came out?
I was a little after that, but yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Boy, is that movie ham-fisted.
Exactly. We turned this big tragic event, and when they tried to turn it into the old type of Hollywood melodrama that we're used to, it was incredibly tasteless.
Yeah.
There were two films about... Actually, this one's about the first Iraq War, but Jarhead.
Which came out around the time of like the second Iraq War, but it was about the first, so it was kind of like MASH. It's about the Korean War, but it's also
really,
about Vietnam.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah, like that kind of thing.
And that's about just sort of how boring the soldier's experience is to the point where you don't even necessarily need to witness combat to have your mind just sort of erased by this military mindset. It's like, we're going to get you prepared for combat. We're going to ship you to exotic locations. You're going to be a man of action. No, you're not. Sit there and breathe in poison and do nothing.
And let the people in the sky do all the work. Mm-hmm. And so we prepared everybody to be mindless killers, and we didn't even let them kill. And that's a weird scene.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, actually, because when they first mentioned, and this is just how old I am, when they first mentioned the Iraq War, my first thought was the first Iraq War, Operation Desert Storm, where I feel like the movies we got out of that were all over the place. Because, like, half of them were stuff like Hot Shots, where it was just like Saddam Hussein.
We have an
over-the-top fascist dictator that we can make fun of the way like we used to make fun of, like, Hitler in Three Stooges cartoons, right? Shorts. And then there was stuff that was actually, like, really serious and harrowing. Like Courage Under Fire is a very good Iraq War movie. I highly recommend it. Great cast. Lou Diamond Phillips, never better. I always thought he should have gotten an Oscar nomination for that movie. But then we also started getting, as we had a little distance from it, we started realizing the sort of millennial approach to war and how we're not just going to look at war as it's all bad or it's all good. We're going to start looking at war as a tool of the machine.
Yeah.
And how it affects people, and how Americans aren't always the good guys, and how corporations are involved in this, and how the United States government doesn't always have the best interests of everybody at heart. And then we started getting films like Three Kings, which really blew a lot of people away at the time. And it's still quite good. But yeah, after 9/11, that was such a traumatic event. There was no distance from war whatsoever that we just started getting these really intense films. And then we started getting... Around the 2010s-ish, we started getting enough distance from 9/11 that it stopped being quite so just all harrowing. And we started getting more films about how we've been embroiled in the same conflict, or conflict in the exact same region, for so long that a whole lot of people were either veterans or new veterans, and they kind of wanted to see Marine soldiers, people in the military, portrayed in a positive light, because there was so much negativity around it. And the negativity around it because those wars were shit, as indeed almost all wars always have been. But, you know, we support the troops. Of course we do. So we started getting films like Lone Survivor or Act of Valor or American Sniper, movies which were, you know, maybe they had some critique about elements of the war, how war is hell, but the soldiers themselves...
very, very pro-military.
Yeah, they were ultimately very pro-military, and it was interesting because initially there was this real desire to either not give in to propaganda. We haven't had, like, a major full sweep of, like, propaganda... like unabashed propaganda for a while now. Like
beyond these military films.
But there hadn't been for a while. Like, I feel like we had the Green Beret around the time at the start of the Vietnam War, and that was supposed to be like the pro-military, pro-Vietnam War movie, and people rejected it outright. And then the overall effect of Vietnam War movies was this war sucks, and it was a bad idea, and it was bad all around. And I feel like that tone affected all the other military conflicts since that we made movies about. And then these other ones went on so long that eventually people cracked it and found a way to do the propaganda without making the war seem itself cool.
Yeah.
And so we got a lot of, what was that one that Chris Hemsworth was in with the horses? It's like 12 Strong
Golly, yeah. That sounds about right.
12 Strong. Yeah. Boy, is that one unabashedly corny.
They should just call it Chris Hemsworth and the Horses.
Yeah, that's unabashedly corny. Mm. It's not badly made. It's just corny. I mean, you can't really accept it as anything resembling reality because there's a scene where, like, Chris Hemsworth comes back to life and, like, raises his horse from the dead so that he can... And he, of course, was dead. And then he just Chris Hemsworth just gets up and they have that Saving Private Ryan thing where all the sound falls out. And then Chris Hemsworth just, like, gives that whistle. I can't do it. Like, and then the horse just goes, back into battle, baby. And it's like fucking He-Man's cat. Like, it's just so... It's propaganda. It's unabashed propaganda, but they found a way to make it seem less like it. Because there's always this desire to sell people stuff.
Well, those
kinds...
To
sell people the idea that this is positive.
Those kinds of movies actually do shed a light on how we film action in cinema. How action films are just combat. It's just war.
Yeah.
All action sequences. You know, it
to some extent, but yeah.
To some extent, but you know, we're getting a thrill off of violence.
Yeah.
That is, and it's usually in the context of a good guy is going to do violence to a bad guy, and we can get a thrill on that. We can get the sort of moral charge, and all of that is sort of an echo of what combat is supposed to represent.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're saying they're trying to, like, make combat look like action movies, but action movies are already kind of influenced by combat.
Yeah. Before I move on real fast, are there any particular films from about the recent... the recent wars that we've been embroiled in for so long that we haven't mentioned that you think are actually worth seeking out?
I've noticed that there are a lot recently about, like, it's going back to the top. Oliver Stone made W. Mm-hmm. Adam McKay made Vice about Bush and Cheney, respectively.
Yeah, so that's about it politically. Yeah,
yeah, and not The Program, that was the Lance Armstrong. The one about the torture memos.
Oh, the...
it had a really bland name. The Adam Driver movie.
Started with a C, didn't it? The Cabinet, the Portfolio.
The Portfolio, yeah. It had,
the Campaign, the...
I can't even remember the title. It was a good movie, too.
Hold on, Adam Driver.
Just think of Adam Driver movies.
War movie.
Yeah, it's about the torture memo. I think it was just called, like, The Memo or such thing.
Thingy Doodle. Hold on. I'll find it.
But that was a film about from just a couple of years ago that was about uncovering these torture memos. We had Errol Morris making a film called Standard Operating Procedure, which was about the tortures that were going on at Guantanamo.
The Report.
The Report. Why couldn't I remember that?
That's, again, much more generic than that.
The Report. It was about the torture report. They should call it The Torture Report.
Then at least it sticks in your craw, you know? Yeah.
So, in recent memory, there have been a lot of good films that have been really kind of delving into this reckoning we've been having with sort of the messages that were sold us, and we're finally able to separate it and place blame places. But unfortunately, it's not leading to this great wave of justice. We're just sort of saying everything about that war was lies and unjust. And there was also the Valerie Plame movie.
Which one? There were a couple.
The one with Naomi Watts and Sean Penn.
Fair Game.
Fair Game.
Yeah, that's a good one, actually. I like the one a lot.
That one's a good one, too. Yeah.
That one's really smart because it's about... and that was a Doug Liman movie, actually, who did The Bourne Identity. It's about the lead-up to the second war in Iraq when there was all like, oh, they have all these weapons of mass destruction, and Valerie Plame and all these other people at CIA are like, no, they don't. And they're like, well, we think they do. And I'm like, well, we had all these people and all these boots on the ground and we did all this research and no, they literally don't. And what happened is they released like Valerie Plame's, like they basically doxed her and revealed that she was a member of the CIA and everything. And they basically tried to discredit her while also completely drawing attention away from the actual issue, which is that we're going to war for bullshit reasons. And that movie's really, really clever because... at about the time you realize, wait a minute, wasn't this about a war and the movie's gotten really distracted by all this shit about Valerie Plame in the media? And you go like, oh shit, that's really smart filmmaking, actually. Mm. They just fucking did it. That's a good one. I actually hadn't thought about that one. The one I recommend, and it's actually, I think it might be about the original Iraq War, is a really great HBO miniseries called Generation Kill, which was from the makers of The Wire. It's really great. It's an incredible cast. And it really does portray the actual war, boots on the ground war, as the clusterfuck that it was. And how completely unprepared, and how bureaucracy was getting in the way of doing anything even remotely resembling the right thing. And how some people just literally shouldn't have been there. Like, they were not qualified to be there. And they're ruining everything for everybody. And it really does feel like a combination of, like, in the Iraq War, of, like, Catch-22 and MASH... And, like, with, like, just a little platoon. Like, it's a really, really great, thoughtful, well-researched, funny, surprisingly, but very serious miniseries. It's on HBO Max. It got completely overshadowed, I think, when it came out by, like, other bigger miniseries. But I highly recommend it. Generation Kill, I'd seen it first. It's one of the reasons why I didn't love The Hurt Locker so much. Okay. Like, I admire it. It's a good movie. But, like, Generation Kill was so much more... to me, what I felt like we needed to be seeing and talking about. And the fact that it was like 6 hours long obviously helped, but it got more real estate. Do we have time for one more?
Sure.
Let's do one more letter. Yeah.
I love The Hurt Locker, by the way. I think that's a terrific movie.
Yeah.
Here's a letter from the Irreverent Reverend. His name is Zach. The Irreverent Reverend Zach.
Hi, Zach.
Greeting Bibbs and Whitney. Sorry, I have no cool spelling for Rockmeister McCool. That's fine.
Yeah.
That's my letter's name. I am 30 now. Mazel tov, and shockingly didn't have a massive crisis about it as I expected to, but I have noticed one thing. I find myself growing ever so tired and evilly annoyed by subcultures that I used to be a part of. Welcome to your 30s.
Yes! Hits you like a ton of bricks.
Oh, yeah,
like
it really does.
30th birthday, just boom, done.
I grew up a wrestling fan, and now I can't stand the majority of wrestling fans. I became a YouTube guy in college, but I find myself either bored or annoyed with the content that or personalities of the people I used to enjoy. I think I'm just burnt out on, quote, personality-driven content over content that focuses on substance or expertise. My taste in movies has changed, too. I saw Iron Man in theaters and was hooked on Marvel until about Civil War. And now I'm just more annoyed with the barrage of news and posts I see about them. They're fine blockbusters, but I don't necessarily think they're anything special.
Right.
I've always had a reputation for being pretentious. Oh, brother.
When the pandemic's over, Whitney will give you a hug.
Yeah. I think I was first called pretentious when I was like 13. It's just, yeah, golly. In high school, I would go to closing video stores and buy every indie presenting DVD and then watch them. I found some gems like Win-Win and Elephant and Jerry.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Jerry's a hoot.
I like Win-Win a lot. That's an underappreciated film.
I never saw Win-Win, but I've seen Elephant and I've seen Jerry. Yeah. I like relatively obscure bands and read relatively obscure books. So I guess my question is this just part of everyone growing into their 30s to just outgrow the media they used to enjoy? Or is this more of a byproduct of the aforementioned pretentiousness? Did either of you experience growing out of a subculture or quite possibly multiple shifts like this in your own lives? I still enjoy science fiction. The Expanse is excellent, and fantasy, but what I consider a wide range of films, I'm having trouble filling my entertainment time as my tastes shift. I found you both through the Schmodown, another casualty of something I really enjoyed but have become lethargic towards in the last couple of years.
Fair enough.
And now listen to basically everything you put out. Oh, thank you.
That's very kind of you. Thank you.
Keep it up. Know there is a desire for a critical eye in an age where it seems having a nuanced opinion on media is a lost art.
You know, I there's a lot in what you just said. I don't want to talk about it because there's a lot of nuance involved. But I myself am very heartened. That, you know, Wendy and I, we talk about, you know, we have podcasts about Star Trek and Batman, like on our Patreon. We're not completely outside of nerd culture. But it really, really warms my heart to find out how many people who are, like, writing in are watching stuff like Onibaba.
Yeah.
And, like, because it reminds you that people are still watching this stuff just because it sucks out all the oxygen. Mm. All these franchises suck out all the oxygen in so many online spaces, whether it's Twitter or YouTube or whatever movie review site you follow.
Mm.
You know, so much of it is about the same stuff.
Yeah.
I like a lot of that stuff. But it's only actually like a small part of what's out there, and it takes up all the energy, it takes up all the air. Realizing that there's so much more out there is, I hope, a somewhat inevitable part of growing up, and that you just realize you gain more experience, you gain more wisdom, and then whether you find the same stuff or go off in a completely different direction than other people you know, hopefully you realize that there's just even more. Because there is. You can keep liking the old stuff. There's that old expression, like, When I was a child, I thought as a child. I did stuff as a child. Mm. And then as an adult, I did adult stuff and did other stuff that I didn't do as a child. And
so that's a weird quote of the Bible, but okay.
Yeah, I'm paraphrasing. Yeah. But the idea is that when you're an adult, you're supposed to put away childish things. That's actually bullshit.
Well,
you can totally keep reading comics. You can totally
go back to the passage. It actually says, I spake as a child. I understood as a child.
There you go.
And when I became an adult, I put away childish things. It's not about stopping playing with your toys.
Yeah. Well, that's a lot of people interpret it that way. Yeah. I just want to say that, like, thank you for knowing the actual quote. Yeah. But my point is this. You don't have to, like, disregard stuff from when you were younger. Uh-huh. But it's also okay if you do. It's completely okay to grow out of something or even just grow out of parts of it. Again, you mentioned in your email, you still like a lot of the Marvel movies. Mm. A lot of them are good. I understand growing out of the hype because it takes a lot of time and energy and there's this weird fanaticism involved in some of it from a lot of people, whether or not that's you, and it just gets exhausting.
I've noticed a lot of that hype machine and a lot of the advertising world in general is geared toward young single people.
Yeah.
You'll notice the advertising around, if there's a married couple depicted in a TV commercial, they're doing domestic stuff.
Yeah.
It's about cleaning your kitchen or preparing your breakfast. Whereas most other ads are, wear this and you'll get to fuck.
Yeah, it's or like you'll be like jumping out of a plane or you're doing all these cool like mountain climbings. And
the taste of these chips is extreme. It's corn. Yeah, but it's extreme corn with powder on it. Oh, it's corn cheese powder. Uh-huh. That's not extreme, guys.
It's not.
But that's sort of the language they're using. And I think because of that, and because there's so much just loose income and advertising dollars that can fund this machine, that's where the loudest noise is coming from.
Yeah.
So you start to, when you're growing out of it, you start to get this pushback. It's like, okay, I'm not going to do that. Why are you putting it down? There's no reason to put it down. Keep on doing it.
We're looking at this specifically in terms of like pop culture.
Yeah.
But this goes beyond that. This goes everything from like, hey, we're going out drinking tonight. I'm like, no, I'm 30. I want to stay in and read a book.
Yeah.
Like that's part of that too.
That will bring me pleasure now.
Yeah. Like I don't need this I don't need to constantly feel like I'm doing things.
Yeah.
I can do other things and I'm fine with it. And the peer pressure is just getting annoying now. Yeah.
What happens when adults try to recapture that magic? See any movie about bros.
Yeah.
Watch The Hangover. That's what that movie is about.
It's fun for a night and then you get bored with it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. So I remember I was on back when I was still doing Geekscape stuff, I was on a podcast. I was on with Jonathan London, who was running Geekscape, and he still does his own thing. Look up Jonathan London. He's got his own stuff, just to give him a little bit of plug. And I was having a conversation with somebody who was in your situation, listener, about how they had, like, I think they had just turned 31, and they just said, they're announcing all these brand new TV shows, and it's like these big, long, complicated mythologies, and I just don't really have the energy for that level of fandom anymore. And I just said, welcome to your 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that happens a lot to people who just reach a certain age. Now, some people can continue that. They can go into their 50s and 60s and still be fanatical. Forrest J. Ackerman is the godhead of that kind of movement.
Yeah.
He never stopped being a monster movie fan. And there are some people who are my age. I'm in my mid 60s. And, some people who are
in his early 40s.
I'm in my early 40s, and there are some people who are around my age who are still doing that. It's like I watch Captain America: Civil War like once a week. I still love it. It's like, okay,
cool,
that's fine, do it. But there are a lot of people who, by necessity, because they just sort of grow up and lose interest in stuff, move on to other things, and because of this advertising machine, there's this message in our heads that growing up and moving on isn't okay.
Yeah, it's not cool. There's no place for you. And this is something that's actually really important to me when we were talking about, like, who are we try not to get too caught up on this, but there was some conversation that we've had before about, like, who are we making podcasts for? And I've worked as like an editor for like websites and things before, and I've worked writing for various geeky websites, and what I realized eventually was that every single one of these websites, if you're there for a couple of years, you might not notice, but if you're there for 10, you realize that you are growing up, But the target demo is staying the same age.
Yeah.
You're constantly writing to people in like their 20s or even their teens, and you need to kind of write towards their interests. But I myself am growing up, and I realized there's no entertainment media that has a prominent presence that is not catering to people in their early 20s.
Yeah.
I mean, there's overlap, sure. I like superhero movies as much as anybody. I do. But there's all of these people who are who grew up with all this geeky stuff and still like it. Mm. And still like movies and TV and music and all this other media. But they're growing up now.
Yeah.
And they're in their 30s, their 40s, 50s, maybe older. They've got kids, sometimes they got grandkids, and their perspectives are different. And the stories that are hitting them or that interest them or excite them aren't necessarily the exact same stories that are exciting to people who are 20. And yet, we're not making space for them. Mm. We're not making, you know, media for them. We're not making websites for that crowd. Even though that's the exact same crowd we were recording 10, 15 years ago.
Mm.
They have the exact same number of people. We're just expecting them to absorb the exact same stuff the exact same relatively immature way.
Mm. And have the same take on it and the same attitudes about it.
So, like, what we, I think, have been doing consciously or unconsciously is trying to make space for people who are getting past it. You know, you're a Star Wars, a Star Trek geek. You've read comic books before. You like a lot of this stuff. But we're at a point now where we don't feel like covering it the same old way. We like looking at it from the perspective of people who are older, have some perspective, whether it's the right perspective. That's why we have many other shows out there for other people. But we want to look at it in a different way. And we want to make sure we make time for other stuff, for older movies, for movies from other cultures, for TV shows that nobody else gives a shit about. We want to make sure that there's a place for that. And if that makes us kind of a niche audience, okay. But we've got each other, and there's not a lot of other places to go.
It is a pity, though, that is niche, and that the expected attitude toward pop media is the attitude of a younger person.
Yeah.
Now, that's exciting because there's a point in your life when you're going to be discovering stuff for the first time and you get excited about stuff for the first time.
It's wonderful.
But a lot of that self-perpetuating, like, YouTube personality cycle that you were referring to is designed not to push out and discover new things.
Yeah, a lot of it's running after what we call search engine optimization, which is what are people already talking about? Well, we'll talk about that. And I always say to people, many of them who are more successful than I am, say, listen, you have a platform, and it's such a big platform, and you're talking about the same five movie franchises over and over again. Can you maybe take a little time to talk about something else and help use your platform to introduce people? And oftentimes they say they'd like to, but it just doesn't get traffic, so they can't afford to do it. I understand.
And they don't want to put the resources into what is considered a risk.
I understand where that comes from, but I also, for me, I feel like the responsibility outweighs that. Mm. And so, yeah, if this keeps us from becoming the biggest thing ever, fine. But what I hope is that we can maybe help normalize this idea that it is possible to like all different kinds of media and to like all different kinds of movies and to like enjoy, you know, you can enjoy Batman and you can enjoy
Knights and Rodanthe.
Yeah. And you can enjoy Airport 77 and you can enjoy All Quiet on the Western Front and you can enjoy Black Orpheus and all of these things that might not seem connected. They're connected because we contain multitudes. We're interested in all of it. And we think a lot of people are interested in things and they're sometimes not encouraged to, and we want to encourage them. So thank you for a really great email.
Yeah, thanks for writing that in.
Yeah, that's
something that's relevant and that I've been pushing against ever since I turned 30.
We're really passionate about it, and it's rare that we get a chance to talk about it so directly. So thank you so much for giving us that opportunity. And thank you, everybody who wrote into We've Got Mail. That is it for this week. Once again, if you want to write into the show and ask us questions, recommendations, whatever you want to talk about, we're pretty open books. You can email us. The email is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We also have a Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, where you can vote for future episodes of our shows. You also get a ton of exclusive content, including shows about Star Trek, Batman, every single film ever nominated for the Academy Award for Best Picture, movies that Disney is trying to sweep under the rug by not putting on Disney+, commentary tracks. We've just put out a poll right now for help us decide what romantic movie we're going to do a commentary track for in February. And a ton of other stuff besides.
Yeah.
So that's patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. A very special thank you to all of our patrons, without whom we would not be here. We could not afford to be here. We would... this whole network would not exist. So we're incredibly grateful to you for that. And of course, we're on Twitter at Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
And again, if you're interested, Michelle, as mentioned, has a book, Hooker, which is a feminist, pro-queer, pro-sex work, retro-wave, 1980s vigilante slasher novel. It's awesome. And also, we have a new soap business over on Etsy called Salt Cat Soap, where we have soaps that we make. And they're really, really quite nice. And people are starting to get them and enjoy them. And that makes that really is cool. So thank you, everybody. And once again, sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney.